The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Questions afterward.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Tristan, and thank you all for coming, and thank the ISO for the invitation. Always a pleasure to take part in socialism. I've been blamed for the title. You know, I tried to find something intriguing a little bit, something people can remember easily. Has the Arab Spring lost its spring? It's an easy play on words, so pardon me for that, but the meaning is clear. And indeed, there are basically two views of this spring, of the Arab Spring, of the nature of this spring, if we can call it like that. One view, which was by far the dominant, the mainstream view, not only actually in Western countries, but even globally, and that was very, very much so in Western countries, and in some way under the Obama administration, this was in tune with some pretension of that administration. The view that what was happening then, that was in 2011, was a kind of final stage of the transformation of the world in the direction of the combination of liberal democracy with market economies, free market economies, neoliberal economies. That was the idea. You know, the famous, if you remember, the end of history, which was supposed to be a few decades behind us now. So history was supposed to have ended with this combination. And the Arab countries and other countries were regarded as some kind of islands of resistance to this end of history. And there you had it, 2011. Even Fukuyama, the end of history man, you know, praised what was happening as confirming his views, and that was after he had explained previously how Islam was an exception to what he was saying. So then he again changed his mind. And actually, at the beginning, what was happening was a kind of heavy blow to Orientalist perspectives about the region, in the sense that, you know, what the most common kind of Orientalist perspective on the region is that, they have what they are accustomed to. You know, these people, they are not longing for democracy like us. They are accustomed to dictatorship, to despotism. That's part of their culture. That's how it went. And if ever they were to move beyond that, they would have to move beyond their culture, whatever, again, this would mean. And then you had this fantastic, huge uprising, one of the most spectacular we've seen in history, absolutely amazing. And then the view was, well, after all, they are like us, the people there. They are longing to issues for which we also are longing. So then there is something behind that. And then you had the setback. And you have a comeback with a vengeance of the Orientalist perspective. We told you so, said so many people. Can't have anything positive coming from there, and if you disrupt the despotic order, what you get is Islamic extremism, fundamentalism, whatever the term, that's what you get. Because it's built in their culture. It's a genetic program of the populations of the region. That's basically the kind of view. Well, even from that perspective, I would say one could point to a recent event which happened after even the titling of this session, a major mass movement, could say even uprising or a spring, let's use it, that term, in Jordan, where you had the first time a popular movement overthrowing a government, basically, or forcing the departure of a government. And that could be seen as some echo of or continuation of what happened in 2011. But Jordan is a small country, not enough to reverse the whole picture again. Then, well, it confirmed also something else just before I move from that, that the main gain, if you want, the main lesson of the Arab Spring is real democracy, which means ability of people to bring down governments and change governments in the streets when they don't have the ability to do that by really democratic mechanisms, which are not the formal kind of democracy where you have to wait a few years, whatever you think of the rulers, in order to change them. But that's a side issue. The second view of that is of the Arab Spring. The second view of the spring of the Arab Spring is that that was essentially rooted in a social economic massive social economic problem, which led and translated into a political explosion. One could see in what happened actually a kind of textbook illustration of Karl Marx's theory of revolution, in the sense of revolution as the result of the clash between the development of the economy and the needs for economic development, and the kind of social political setting that exists and that hampers, that blocks this development. That's how Marx analyzed revolution in an epochal sense. We're not speaking of any kind of rebellion here or there against, for instance, a despotic government. It's social revolution. It's the social transformation that is connected to big political upheaval. And that was Marx's theory of that. And we have, as I said, a textbook illustration of that in the Arab Spring, with countries, a whole region, which has been having very slow rates of economic growth, the highest rates of unemployment in the world, all sorts of social economic problems, which were specific, many of them, to that region, and which were compounded result of the neoliberal transformation, compounded by the kind of conditions you have there. And from that perspective, if we understand this explosion in 2011 as the product of a structural crisis, a deep structural crisis, you would then understand that it couldn't be solved in a few weeks or a few months or even a couple of years, okay? That is an epochal change, what I call a long-term revolutionary process. It's the concept of processes here is very important. Revolutionary process, not just a revolution. That is something that is protracted and that goes into phases of revolution and counter-revolution, of upsurge and setbacks and defeats and the rest, like any revolutionary process, protracted revolutionary process in history. From that angle, we have much more than Jordan. From that angle, this year, 2018, started with explosions in Sudan, Tunisia, Morocco, and you even had this recent one in Jordan, which was, the main thing was, it wasn't about changing the regime, it was about social economic issues. It's not that people didn't want to change the regime, but it takes a lot of political boldness to dare say that in a country like Jordan, because you face the harshest possible repression in that case. And even it extended beyond the Arab-speaking world into Iran, because we've had in Iran also a big, massive social protest at the end of last year, beginning of this year. Now, let me just comment very quickly on the Iranian issue. It is not part of the same phenomenon in the sense that the structural conditions in Iran are not the same as those in Arab countries. Iran is a country under specific conditions, under sanctions blocking its, I mean, the main, they have, the sanctions play a key role in producing the kind of social economic problems that you have there. And it's a country where you have high expectations. It's a country that has the potential of being like Turkey in terms of level of industrialization, the rest, much more than compared to other Arab countries. So it's a country with a much more potential from that regard. But what you have in common, and there is something in common between Iran and all the other cases, what they have in common is three letters, IMF. That's what they have in common. They have in common that all the events I mentioned, behind all the events I mentioned, including Iran, which people don't know most of the time, the IMF is there. Iran itself was implementing IMF recommendations when it had what we have been seeing. And that goes for all the countries we mentioned. We can call them, in that sense, IMF revolts, in the sense that they are triggered under different conditions, but they are triggered by the neoliberal measures recommended by, or even imposed in some way, dictated by the IMF. Now, it's precisely these issues, what we could call the workings of neoliberalism in the Arab countries, that are behind this worsening of the social economic problems that exploded in 2011. And in that sense, the IMF really confirmed what it has been labeled defined or described as international market fundamentalism, which is exactly what it is. It's the most dogmatic perspective about the role of the market and the role of the private sector as being the only real engine of growth and development. And that failed miserably in the part of the world we are discussing. And I'm not saying that from a dogmatic perspective, which is countering a dogmatism with a counter-dogmatism. I do recognize, we should recognize, that there are countries with a big social price all the time, but where neoliberalism led to economic development. Okay, Turkey is one of them. You mentioned Turkey, Chile, India. You have a number of countries, not China, by the way, but that's another issue. In this part of the world, and in most of the world, one should say, this is not working, but in the Arab countries, it's dramatically not working. It's a major and massive failure leading to what we have, because the kind of private sector you have under the conditions in that region, and they don't have time to expand on that, produce a politically determined capitalism, which seeks short-term profit, which would go therefore into speculative kind of activities, and that won't solve any of the problems. On the contrary, that just keeps the problems increasing, and the best illustration of that is Egypt. Egypt, which today has been now, since November 2016, the country of the region that has implemented in the most brutal and the most radical manner the IMF recipes. It used to be called shock therapy, and that's exactly what you got in Egypt, a terrible shock. The problem is that they won't get the therapy. They got the shock. That's the problem. And that's a huge problem, because the whole idea of the regime in doing all that is to create the conditions for a massive influx of capital in investment, foreign investment, from the Gulf Cooperation Council, that is the Gulf oil monarchies. That's what the regime is betting on, is expecting, plus other kind of foreign investment that could be added, but the bulk expected is that. Now the problem, as even recently an article in Financial Times was explaining, something we've been explaining for a long time, is that under the conditions that you have, Gulf investment is going in real estate, is going in the same rentier, speculative kind of investment. It's not going in industrial projects. It's not going to solve the issue. And that means that it's actually increasing the problem. Demography, which is quite dynamic in this part of the world, means more and more unemployment, a huge unemployment problem. And this is now combined with a huge inflation rate. The inflation is tremendous, and this is inflation to a large extent by money depreciation because of the floating of the currency and other issues like that. So the social pressure is mounting in that country. If it's not exploding like the rest, it's because it had behind it now a few years of upheaval that ended in a terrible repression, and the regime is using this fear, this terror, call it by its name, and the threat, or the how to say, repulsive image of what you have all around in Syria, in Libya, in Yemen, in order to say it's us or the chaos, it's the dictatorship or civil war. That's the main argument of such regimes nowadays. So the regional crisis is worsening. With such arguments, you can hold it for a while, but the pressure is getting so unbearable that sooner or later, Egypt will again explode. And anyone believing that Sisi is the end of history, Egyptian version, is just completely illusioned. Now let me get to the politics of the crisis, of this protracted crisis. And there we have big complexity. If we look at the social political forces involved, the system of states in the region is dominated by those, the jargon would say, patrimonial and patrimonial states, that is states that are either owned, privately owned, like private ownership of ruling families, regarding the state as their own, and the armed forces as their private guards, you know, if you, and others where you don't have the same family control, but you have a whole range of nepotistic crony, various terms, going in the same direction, conditions of relation. That is, what you have is either, I mean, you have power elites in the quantitative term, meaning, which are either ruling families or a local version of what C. Wright Mills called for this country, the power triangle. That is, capitalist interest, military, and the political apparatuses. That's what you have, and that's the existing blockage. That's what blocking to go back to those Marxist terms that I mentioned. Now, what you have facing that, you have, for historical reasons, Islamic fundamentalist forces that had filled the vacuum left by the collapse of the left in this part of the world in the 70s and 80s and 90s. This collapse of the left at the regional level was filled by, I mean, the vacuum left by that was filled by Islamic fundamental forces that those same regimes had for a while been using as an antidote, as a weapon against the left, that left that collapsed in part due to what they did in order to defeat it. And then you have a set of left and liberal forces, or what kind of left-liberal coalition that you can find in various countries. So the explosion, the Arab Spring, was a big explosion against these power elites, as I described them in the region. And faced with that, the United States, which is the hegemon in the region, that's the hegemonic power in the region, especially since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the early 90s and the Gulf War, which led Washington to be completely dominant in the region, the United States and the reactionary order had two options. And these two options are represented in the stronghold of counter-revolution, of reaction in the region, which is the Gulf Cooperation Council. That, I mean, those oil monarchies have always been the linchpin of counter-revolution, of reaction in this part of the world. And the two options were represented within that same camp by different states. One, which is the classical counter-revolution support of the existing regime, represented by the Saudi Kingdom and the United Arab Emirates. They are the champions of preserving the existing order, again between quote marks. The other option was represented by Qatar, the Emirate of Qatar, which, for historical reasons, don't have time to get into that, but had become the sponsor of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the main mass-based Islamic fundamentalist organization, movement, current in the region and beyond. And in this connection, Qatar was joined by the Turkish government of Erdogan. So you had a kind of Turkish-Qatari alliance representing a different option. And this option was what? That was one of co-opting the uprising. Yeah, that is, so that's the range of differences you had. Should we crush it or co-opt it and try to organize it? The Obama administration was essentially for the co-optation option. Not in Bahrain, not within the Gulf oil monarchies, because that would be going too far, but in general, that's what they were seeking. What the Obama administration was seeking was what it called orderly transition, and basically some kind of compromise between the old order and that section of the opposition that can be co-opted for a neoliberal and pro-United States functioning, and that is the Muslim Brotherhood. And that's what the Obama administration was pushing for. That was implemented in several countries. Morocco was the first country, by the co-optation of the Muslim Brotherhood in that country by the king, by the monarchy, and bringing them into government. In Yemen, you had a compromise with the Gulf countries behind and the benediction of Washington. Eventually, in Tunisia, you had this kind of coalition and compromise. You had attempts at having the same. The Obama administration wanted that very much for Egypt. And that's the reason why you had a tension between the Obama administration and the Sisi government after the coup. There was a period of very tense relations because of that. And even the European Union also intervened in trying to get into some kind of collaboration between the Muslim Brotherhood and the military. That failed. In the same way it failed in Libya, and above all it failed in Syria, because that was also what they wanted in Syria. Some kind of agreement of coalition of the opposition and the regime, with or without Assad, or with Assad for a transitional period. Yeah, they could discuss, they could negotiate on that, more or less. But the key point was this kind of thing. And that failed, essentially, for the countries, the last few countries that I mentioned. And what we got in was the aggravation of the clash between the old order and the Islamic fundamentalist-dominated opposition. And this reached its peak in Syria, into a local version of what I call the clash of barbarisms, when you have, on the one hand, the regime, on the other hand, a range of extreme totalitarian Islamic fundamentalist forces, the worst of which is, of course, ISIS. But you have Al-Qaeda then, and you have even other little bit milder forms. That's what you get. That is a clash between forces that are on both sides, completely reactionary forces. And you can't, I mean, really to take a stance here with this kind of clash. Syria was the first country where after Bahrain, but Bahrain actually had no perspective, in the sense that if you even look at the map, you would understand that there's no way for anything to happen in Bahrain if the Saudi kingdom is not paralyzed. Okay, so that's a country which is very much dependent on the big brother close to it. But for the dynamics that was unleashed in 2011, and which carried on despite what happened in Bahrain early on, the main reversal, the main turn of the tide, was the intervention of Iran in the Syrian situation, and the counter-revolutionary role of Iran in defeating the Syrian uprising. And that was the turn of the tide, which also will lead to a degeneration of the forms of the opposition in Syria, that is a more and more control of the most reactionary forces within that, and a regime that also, I mean, was keeping in its own degenerative forms of barbarism. Later on, Russia intervened to consolidate this counter-revolutionary turn in Syria, and we can say that Russia has been decisive in what's happening now, which is a victory of the regime with the two backers, and the regime is definitely completely now in control of most of the country. The main obstacle remaining either the presence of Turkey and Turkey connected forces, or the Kurds with the United States backing, with a threat. Actually, Trump wants very much to stop this stop the involvement on the side of the Kurdish movement. In the face of that, the Obama administration carried on trying to get these compromises very actively. Aside from the cases I said, in Egypt they tried to keep the pressure in order to get some kind of understanding, but that wouldn't work. The Sisi regime didn't want to concede anything on that. In Libya, through the United Nations, they tried to negotiate a compromise between the two camps, one in which you find remnants of the old regime, and the other in which you have the Islamic fundamentalist forces. In Syria, they kept trying to get into that. In Yemen, with the war that started in 2014, the same, trying to get to some kind of compromise behind that. With Trump, you have a major shift in US policy towards the region. And given the weight of the United States in this part of the world, that's absolutely decisive. What is the shift? The shift is a shift from the Turkish-Qatari option that was favored by the Obama administration into the Saudi United Arab Emirates. kind of perspective. And actually, you had some version of WikiLeaks about the role of the UAE ambassador in Washington in concocting all that, and working with the Trump group before even Trump was elected, and all that. They have a lot. There's a lot there in that regard. Where did Donald Trump go for his first visit abroad as POTUS? He went to the Saudi Kingdom, and he went with a message, which is no more Muslim Brotherhood. Tell the Qataris to stop that. 2 weeks after his visit, you had the crisis, the so-called Qatar crisis in the Gulf Cooperation Council. That's very much linked to the Trump administration at that point. And at that point, you even still had one of the guys with whom the United Arab Emirates coordinated most, your fantastic Steve Bannon, and his Islamophobic agenda, which found something in common with the United Arab Emirates in concentrating on the Muslim Brotherhood. So that's where things stand now. To which you should add a major aspect of the shift between Obama and Trump. It's the same. The Obama policy was one of conciliation. That's also the case with Iran. With the major view being, let's create, you know, conciliatory conditions, and that will favor the reformist. And that's we want. I mean, regime change is not on the agenda because that's too big a country, and we had a disaster in Iraq. We're not going to go into another much bigger disaster in Iran. Okay, so let's use or bet on the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe option of change from within, but by creating the conditions for that and to favoring these reformist forces. Trump, and behind Trump on this issue, Netanyahu, Israel, is completely against that kind of perspective. They are for military action against Iran. And the threat of that, you know, you read recently, like I did in the press, that Donald Trump wanted to intervene militarily in Venezuela. So if he was considering that, which is something to which the environment of Venezuela is completely hostile. Mind you, for Iran, with the Saudis and Israelis very much in favor of anything like this, that's very much on the cards. So this perspective is a major perspective today. And a key issue in this regard is Russia. And that's one of the key reasons of Donald Trump's attitude towards Putin. It's not that he's some kind of dove and anti-Cold War person, as some people tend to portray him in what is called the left. Donald Trump's agenda is one of, well, we have much in common with Vladimir Putin. Let's play on all that. We are both reactionaries. We have we share the same values, and I don't give a damn about Ukraine and all that. Let's get a deal. But the condition on our side of the deal is to eject Iran out of Syria and to bring Russia on our side in the confrontation with Iran, okay? That's what Trump wants, and that's why he badly wants this meeting with Putin, despite the special relation with Theresa May, which proved very special indeed. That's what he doesn't, again, also give a damn about Britain in that regard, and we'll be, I'm just going back in time for the big demo against him on the 13th of June, of July, I mean the end of next week. But his main concern is that, and that's what will be on the agenda of this summit that will happen in a few days between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. How far they can agree, disagree, find, but you can be sure that the intention is fully positive. I mean, if Donald Trump was full of positive intentions towards Kim Jong-un, he certainly has much more in common with Vladimir Putin than with the other guys. So we may expect. So this very much will be determinant to what will happen in the region. But in any case, for the revolutionary process, that's a cementing and consolidating of the counter-revolutionary alliance. And that's not good news, but in a sense, that makes things probably clearer. That's the only positive aspect of it. Finally, and I conclude with that, this alliance of progressive, this progressive alliance that I mentioned, the left-liberal kind of conglomerate of forces, where does it stand? Well, we have to make a distinction between the really existing and the potential. The real and the potential. The real, first, the situation for now is one of failure, of defeat. This coalition of forces has been defeated, in some cases badly defeated. In cases like Syria or Egypt, it has been badly defeated. In other cases, the situation is less tragic, and the failure is much less acute. That's, for instance, the case of Tunisia. But for many countries, it's been quite devastating. And the failure here, the failure is everywhere. The failure is due either to objective reasons of weakness and all that of these forces, which many of which are quite limited because they have been submitted to such repression in the past, or it's an and or situation, actually subjective reasons, and the subjective reasons is the failure of these forces to project themselves as an alternative. As an alternative regime, if you want. The people want to overthrow the regime, fine, but the issue is they didn't project themselves as we want to build another regime of this kind under the kind of condition that we are aiming at. That means also a failure to build an alternative that is an alternative to both the existing, the old order, and the reactionary alternative to the old order in the form of the Islamic fundamentalist opposition. That failure, which you will find everywhere, this political failure, this and sometimes oscillation between aligning with the one against the other and then again aligning with the other against the first one, which led to a complete loss of even political identity and credibility. That's the key problem until now. Now, the potential. The potential is still there. I mean, even in a country which suffered a terrible devastation like Syria, even in Syria, a big part of those men and women who were the progressive spearhead of the uprising in 2011, most of them, I should say, were preserved by going into exile because they couldn't live in the regime-controlled areas nor in the areas controlled by Islamic fundamentalist forces. And some of them remained in the country with a low profile. Even in Syria, despite everything we said, the potential, there is still a potential, but the potential is much more obvious and tremendous in most other countries, in taking the form of abstention in the elections, even in countries where you have real elections. The only countries where you have, Tunisia has real elections, Iraq has real elections, and in most countries, the last elections in Tunisia, the rate of participation was 1/3. The overwhelming majority of the young people don't go voting. Same goes even for fake elections like Egypt. The regime is not able to mobilize people to go, you know, and give some credibility to the fake election that the regime is organizing. And mostly these are the young people. And these are the young people who did the Arab Spring. And the reason why they don't go to vote is that because there is no offer that corresponds to their dreams, their aspirations, their perspective. And that's the huge potential that exists. This potential will depend essentially on the possibility of the emergence of political forces representing it and constituting, building an alternative and a clear alternative to both wings of the reaction or the counter-revolutionary setting in the region. That's the key condition for the long-term revolutionary process to reach a positive conclusion. And a positive conclusion would mean a radical social political change in the region, without which there's no unblocking of the crisis of the region. And in that sense, as much as it is now obvious on the global level with what is happening, it's very tragically obvious in the region that the alternative in historical sense and the alternative for this long-term revolutionary process is really socialism or barbarism. That's the two potential options that you have on the card, and it's really, really either one or the other. Thank you very much.
So we will conduct this like most of the discussions here, where I'll ask people to raise their hands. I'll keep a speaker's list, and I'm going to ask people to keep it to about 3 minutes. If you hear me.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.